We are recording.
Hello.
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 Welcome to Must Day and Age. I'm Matt.
I'm Richard.
And we, every week or so, we talk about things in the entertainment industry that pique our interest. New movies, the old movies, DVDs, TV, things of that nature.
Softcore porn on Showtime, Skinamax.
I haven't seen any of that in a while, but I can remember. Like I can remember when I had Cinemax in the apartment. That was good times.
I know.
And it's that was $5 a month. That was worth it.
Ah, youth.
Oh man, what do you mean youth? I'm just too cheap to do it now. Plus, I think my girlfriend would kill me.
So what's on the list today?
All right, in no particular order, David Lee Roth has been kicked out of his role as the East Coast Howard Stern replacement.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, I listen to Howard Stern regularly and
well, hold on. Not just regularly, religiously.
Yeah, I pretty much
just about every time I come over, I can hear it emanating from your computer back there.
Every waking minute. I do like the guy. And it's funny to hear him. He's been actually unbelievably supportive of David Lee Roth. He's saying, you know, it's going to take the guy a long time to find an audience. And so hopefully they won't just kick him out after 3 months. And of course, what'd they do? They kicked him out after 3 months.
Four months.
And you said, and they gave the guy a 3-year multi-million dollar contract. And Stern has all these people on the inside. And he was talking about, he started to realize early on that they were setting Roth up to get rid of him because so they wouldn't have to pay him. And I don't know how that thing's played out and how much they chose to pay him, but essentially he had a 3-year airtight contract. And he was doing everything they asked of him, but they still got rid of him. So it'd be interesting to note whether they somehow don't pay him and what that would say to talent every time you sign a contract where they're going, it makes no difference. We're still not going to pay you or whatever.
Well, radio's a weird world in that respect. I mean, it's Roth had a, well, not national level show.
It was on in 7 markets,
but
it was all on the East Coast. Well, but there are huge markets. I mean, like some of these conservative hosts, they're on 600 stations, but they're nowhere near the level of somebody like Howard Stern got to or somebody else just because they're huge in big markets.
Well, generally when you see air talent, you know, a radio DJ get canned like that before their contract is up, it's because of a format change and they're cleaning house with everybody. So for them, 3 years, that's nuts. And it really 4 months is absolutely no time. You have not given him a chance at all.
Literally, I mean, he hasn't even had a full ratings period.
For the local station KISW, how long did they give those
three
Rob,
Arnie, and Don? Actually, they gave him a considerable amount of time. It was it
a year?
I think it was like 9 months or something, and it was terrible from the get go.
But you know, they gave them a bit of a chance.
Yeah.
I mean, not a tremendous chance, but a lot more than 4 months. So
you know, I think the most interesting thing about this is that they hired for on the East Coast for Ross replacement. They hired Opie and Anthony. Now, here's the story.
They're
Howard Stern wannabes and have always been, and they're somewhat entertaining. But these are the guys that had the couple go to St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City and have sex and call in while they're having sex in the back of a cathedral. And they got fined an enormous amount of money, got kicked off all the stations. They were being syndicated by CBS Radio, and CBS fired them. So then they went to XM Radio and didn't really make any waves. And now the radio show is basically being syndicated by XM back to CBS Radio. So they're still on XM and they're back on CBS. And I think it's funny that CBS, which eviscerated Stern's show for the past 2 years for being so crude, would hire the people that were clearly much, much cruder than Howard Stern. And I don't know how it's going to play off because supposedly they're going to simulcast some of the XM radio show. Well, the XM radio show is completely uncensored. And just like Howard Stern's Sirius show is. So I don't know what's going to be on this. I don't know what's going to be on the network there, but it seems weird. And it seems weird of XM because the whole point to XM is that they're trying to have exclusive content. And what are they doing? They're sending it back to free radio. How are they going to sell radio's that way. I honestly don't get it. I really don't. So,
I don't know.
Anyway, I kind of like David Lee Roth. I would hear him, and I think he's an entertaining, interesting guy, and I felt bad.
You know, the last time I saw David Lee Roth, it was in the beginning to Conan's 10-year primetime anniversary special. That's the last time I can remember anything about that guy.
He was an interesting guy, and periodically they would, you know, Howard Stern has his own news outfit called Howard 100 News, and they would send a reporter, probably the only reporter in the world that was covering this, and he would go and interview David Lee. He would meet him in a parking lot and interview him. And David Lee Roth was pretty open about how he was getting screwed over.
Wow.
And he would talk about it. It was always interesting. So
have you heard any Adam Carolla, the West Coast Stern replacement?
You know, I have. I kind of enjoy it. You know, I like Adam Carolla.
Oh, I love Adam Carolla.
And I you know, it's him, and he's got this
in a respectful way, not in a I wish he was my boyfriend kind of way.
I think the guy's funny, and I've listened to it a lot, and he's so self-deprecating. It's hard to, like, if he does suck, he's the first to point it out and admit it and go into detail about how bad he sucks on a particular bit.
Yeah,
so
I enjoy it. When NPR goes into some boring story in the morning, I'll switch over to Adam Carolla and be entertained for 10 minutes.
Yeah. When Stern goes to an ad, I turn to Adam Carolla too, or NPR. So yeah, I like the guy, and I like his show.
And
so.
My buddy John, I asked him what he thought of it, and he said, well, I like Adam, but his co-hosts and his little sidekick get way too much airtime, and he thinks there's not enough Carolla on the Adam Carolla show, which I can see.
I can see, too, but, man, there's a formula, and there's such thing as too much of one person. You know, on Stern, they have about 8 regular people that talk, and it definitely is the right mix. And with his show, the problem is sometimes his co-hosts and people, they're not that great. They're not as good as Adam Carolla. I think he needs to have somebody that maybe rises to his level.
Well, hopefully they give him enough time to what I was going
to
say.
Develop, to breathe, and not can his ass. Yeah, he's great. Yeah. I like him. So.
When he was on Loveline, I could care less about Loveline, but oh man, Adam Carolla on Loveline was hysterical.
Yeah. That would be the soothing tones of Holly Anderson calling. We'll ignore that call. I'll call her later. So what's next on the list?
I can't believe you have ringtones. This thing about Star Trek, which, you know, you emailed me this during the week. Yep. I'm like, oh, I can see that's a big story. I don't have time to read it.
Yep.
So then, like, 2 days later, I come across the story independently, email it to you, and then feel like a jackass when I realized you emailed it to me earlier.
Basically, I knew you'd be interested.
J.J. Abrams, who just directed Mission Impossible 3.
The guy from Alias, the guy from Lost.
Right. Paramount is having him and his team write and direct a new Star Trek film. And this is going to be the prequel, the Starfleet Academy, Kirk and Spock meeting each other for the first time story. And, God, you know, that particular storyline as a movie has been kicking around for years.
Yeah.
I think Harve Bennett wanted to do it, who was a Star Trek producer. It's been kicking around forever as a possible alternative, as a way to cash in on the Star Trek name without having to pay all the name actors the money they want. So this way you can sort of, I don't know if it's rebooting the franchise, but you can cash into all the Trek money. And if you're going to pay any money, it's maybe Kurt, you know, Shatner and Nimoy doing a bookend remembrance kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'll see it. I think J.J. Abrams does good stuff.
I'll see it if they don't put in the Kirk and Nimoy bookend stuff. I literally don't. I love them. I've loved all of them. I don't want them anymore. It doesn't need it. And that's just that would tell me that a whole bunch of corporate people have put together this movie that, oh, we got to appease the other fans.
Oh, that's how Paramount's been doing Star Trek forever.
I understand. And that's why I'm saying that I won't see it because of that, because that will tell me that, well, I know they got J.J. Abrams. I got excited, but J.J. Abrams bought into all their crap. And if they don't have him, I'll go, wow, he had the pull to do it his way and realize that is not a good thing for this property generally. But that's my thought.
So, yeah, although I have to admit, I'm not quite as excited as I was about the thought of Bryan Singer doing a new Star Trek film. I was really excited about that rumor a couple months ago. So I hope it works.
Well, speaking of, you know, the new X3 movie, they take Magneto and Patrick Stewart or whatever, and they take them and they do this. They've using CGI. they de-age them. So I guess there's scenes of them being younger, but it's using them, but they make them younger in the somehow in the computer. Apparently there's some scenes in there, and it'd be interesting if they did some of that for the Star Trek movie, but I think they're so damn old that I'm not sure that would work.
I remember in the extra material on the Lord of the Rings DVDs when they were showing Ian Holm as a younger Bilbo.
Yeah.
And basically they said, well, they just took clothespins on the back of his head to pull his skin back.
Yeah, I know.
And you're like, wow, what a great low-tech and yet very disturbing solution.
I know.
All right. Next on my list, Sentinel opened this week.
Sentinel. Did you see it?
I did not. I was interested in seeing it, and then Friday at work, I finally was able to go home at a reasonable hour. And I thought, maybe I'll see a movie. I wonder what opened this. Oh, Sentinel opened. So I go over to Rotten Tomatoes, 30%.
Nice.
And God, that's been more and more. That's been happening to me lately.
Well, I was interested in seeing it until I realized Eva Longoria was in it. And I just, as a matter of principle, I just can't stand it.
Are you on an Eva Longoria boycott?
Nothing against her in particular, but I hate these movies that you can just sort of sense how they've lined up the actors and they figured out early on, oh, here's the hot TV property looking to jump kind of thing. And it's like, oh, man. And God dang, Michael Douglas is so damn old, and they keep putting him as kind of like a love interest thing.
But he didn't, in the commercials at least, he didn't strike me as being that old, because apparently he's the same age as Clint Eastwood when Clint Eastwood did In the Line of Fire. Yeah. But Clint Eastwood looked old in that role, and I think that's a great movie. I love that movie.
Yeah.
But to me, Michael Douglas does not look as weathered as Clint
that's
did.
True.
So that didn't bother me at all. The 30% rating on Rotten Tomatoes kept me from spending my money.
Yeah, there isn't that many good adult action movies these days.
You know, it's got Kiefer Sutherland, who... there he is. Okay. He's not a draw for me at all.
Yeah.
And they just extended 24 for 3 years.
I know.
And there's talk of a movie good for him, but how do you extend this property for 3 more years?
Yeah.
Is it going to, you know, Kiefer Sutherland's an Amway salesman next time, and here's how he's trying to make the sale and build his organization.
Jeez, he lucked into a property that was perfect for him, but it got old for me quite a while ago.
What do you do for 3 more years? I watched the first 2 years, and after that I'm like, okay, I'm done. How do you save the world in
on a weekly basis, 20 an hour at a time? Maybe they'll bring back some more cougars.
If he's a lion tamer, that would be interesting.
There you go.
What else is on the list here? You wanted to talk about the Tina Fey, Aaron Sorkin thing.
Oh, yeah. See, I wasn't aware of this. Apparently, you were aware of this, that Tina Fey had developed her own property similar to
Tina Fey,
to
the head writer and Saturday Night Live, incredibly hot.
She wrote Mean Girls, obviously very talented.
Weekend Update with Amy Poehler now.
And it would be produced by Lorne Michaels, but it's basically a more slapstick version of apparently the Aaron Sorkin proposed show. Basically behind the scenes of a Saturday Night Live type show. And I wasn't aware of that, but apparently they're both NBC properties. Tina Fey's being apparently being pitched as a mid-season replacement, but it's kind of too bad that they're both on, because if they're both good, I'd see both of them. I wouldn't even think that they're competing against each other, but that's not the way networks think. Networks nowadays, they literally have the same shows, CSI, three different CSIs, a bunch of Law and Orders, but these are not two versions of the same show. So I'm not so sure they can mentally handle that at NBC, and I sure hope they can, because I absolutely am gunning for Aaron Sorkin's show, and I totally want to see Tina Fey's show. It's like the two shows that I've heard coming up that I absolutely fundamentally am interested in. If they're good, I will watch them forever.
Right, and it's interesting if you think about the business aspect of both. Apparently, I can't remember if it was NBC or Warner Brothers, but there was like a bit of a bidding war to see who would develop or who would get the rights to the Sorkin show, Studio 6, Studio 69, something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
That's kind of a dumb name in my opinion, but
yep.
And it was like some ungodly like $20 million for the rights to develop this show. And it's highly unlikely that they paid all that money and that's the one they're going to kill if they have to. And yet, Tina Fey is, I don't know how powerful she is on Saturday Night Live, but they have to know that she's a key ingredient of any success that show is having right now. At the same time, you know, if things go sour and Tina Fey leaves, she's going to be okay.
Well, the thing about that is, you know, Lorne Michaels has that habit of getting his hooks into these guys when they leave the show. And that's basically what he's doing. When they're looking to leave the show, he helps set them up, like all those Wayne's World movies and all these other movies. He sets them up, at least in the beginning. So she's going to leave. She's going to leave. At least he'll be part of it.
Did he have any involvement in Mean Girls?
I can't remember if he did or not. That's
because she strikes me as being able to do it on her own.
Oh, I totally agree.
Needing him.
Well, this particular show that they're being developed, this is him as the executive producer.
And because you look at everything he's done that hasn't been Saturday Night Live, like
Late Night with Conan O'Brien.
Oh, does he do that?
They okay, when they got rid of Letterman.
I retract my in process snotty comment.
Kids in the Hall. He created that show.
Okay.
So let's not be too dismissive of Lorne Michaels, even though he's a dork.
Well, I look at the movies, yeah, and, you know, Wayne's World I thought was great because yeah, I was the correct age demographic for that movie when it came out.
Yeah.
But some of the other stuff he's done, you just really have to wonder. And he's tried a couple other TV projects that don't do anything and never seem to go anywhere.
Yeah.
And it's just like he keeps trying to branch out and it never quite seems to stick. But as you point out, kids in the, you know, anybody that had anything to do with Kids in the Hall gets a free pass for the rest of their life.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So there we go. So I borrowed your Bubble DVD.
Oh, yeah.
And watched it this week.
So what are your thoughts?
Very, very interesting. There are so many different things to talk about with this movie. So let's begin.
It was a weird movie.
It was, first it was like 70 minutes, 75 minutes.
Yeah, it was like a really short movie.
Remarkably short movie.
Yeah.
Apparently
not really written. Apparently it was structured, but mostly improvised to some extent.
Well, it was kind of like Spinal Tap, only without Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
And that the writer came up with the story and said, you know, you need to get from A to B, but how you get there is up to you. But basically it's Steven Soderbergh, who, Ocean's 11, Out of Sight,
Limey,
really, really good director. excuse me, came up with this idea, to do this multiple distributions at once. He's going to make a movie and then simultaneously release it in the theaters, on DVD and on, I don't know if it was specifically HDNet.
Yeah, it was on HDNet.
I don't know if that was his, somehow release it on TV. So he goes to Mark Cuban, who's the owner of the Dallas Mavericks and owns HDNet.
And also owns Landmark Theaters.
Right, who had just bought Landmark Theaters. And he pitches this idea and sells it. And I guess the deal is for 6 movies.
Yep.
And so Bubble is the first. As a movie itself, on the first go-through, I was a little underwhelmed. But then as I went back and listened to the commentary, I was more impressed. Because it's kind of it's a very small, quiet movie where it's all about, you know, the actors and what's going on. And so there's not a lot of actual action.
And they're not, and the point also is they're not actually actors. They're just people they literally found for a look.
Yeah, it's normal people. Although that being said, they all did a great job.
I know they
did. You would not know that they weren't professional actors or they weren't stage actors.
But, you know, it's funny when you see people in that one. I've seen other movies where they've tried or done this, and it's such a totally different vibe. And they're doing it to some extent to make it feel kind of real and honest. And it's so fundamentally different. And I immediately get sucked in a different way than I do with a really toweringly great acting performance, like a Meryl Streep or somebody. You start to realize that even though I love Meryl Streep and she's great, she is acting. And in a case like this, you'll see somebody being more what felt to me real and honest in a weird sense, not necessarily better movie making, but just definitely a different feel, and it sucks you in a different way. I found that interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, what put me off the most was just because it's set in sort of it's small town Ohio, right across the river from West Virginia, and it's, you know, these characters that are barely scraping by.
Yeah,
and that always just makes me feel really uncomfortable. Because it's always like, oh, you know, only by luck did I end up in my situation. And thank God I don't have to work in a doll factory.
Yeah, painting doll faces.
And live in a trailer, which is just, and yet it's not a depressing, you know, they're really not focusing on that aspect of it. but it's prevalent.
So should we talk about the thing that happened in the movie?
Oh, sure.
Okay, because nobody gives a crap, but somebody gets murdered. This one character murders another character in the movie, and I'm extremely glad I read nothing about this movie because I liked the fact that I couldn't figure out what the hell was going on in this movie because it was so, it just seemed like a series of observations about these poor folks. And then when this thing happens halfway through the movie or later, it was a jolt to me. And then I started to see what was going on with the movie. And so I read some other reviews and I thought they were very well-written reviews, like Manola Dargis's in the Times, New York Times and other places, but God dang it. They mention all the murder and everything completely up front. And that honestly would have ruined my enjoyment of this movie if I had seen that going in. So I'm not sure what I would have expected. I'm not sure how I could have reviewed the movie without going into detail about that. But for God's sakes, I think the reviewers owed it to people not to let that off, especially a movie as small and tiny as this. Ebert did a much better job, but even he still, trying to be coy, gave a bunch of crap away, and he might as well just not have done it.
Well, I mean, the DVD package says basically that there at some point there's a murder mystery.
And I didn't read the package.
I read
too.
It, so I was like, oh, okay. But it just said a murder mystery. It didn't say who, so.
Yeah, I didn't look into it. I didn't even want to do that, so.
Okay.
Because I kind of knew. I read about I think, the first paragraph of Ebert's review, and he gave it 4 stars, and I immediately realized, and he was sort of being coy at the beginning, I realized, I don't want to read the rest of his view. I just want to see this cold, and that's what I did.
Well, and I love the interactions of the characters where it's, you know, sort of this older woman who works this factory with this younger guy, and they've got this friendship, and she's really attached to him, and that just struck me as very honest.
Yeah.
You know, you get these weird relationships that just sort of develop in real life that don't necessarily make sense, that you don't see in a lot of Hollywood films.
Exactly.
So I really enjoyed that. And then going back and listening to the commentary and listening to they shot it in HD,
yep,
with HD cameras, and sort of the specific things he was going for, and the fact he would edit the dailies on his computer, yep, on an Avid Express at night in his, yep, hotel room. And it was a really well thought out thing where he said, you know, we did a big chunk of the movie and then took a couple days off so I could edit. Then, yep, we filmed for a couple days off, a couple days on. And
they did it linearly, which because these guys are non-actors, that probably was the best for them.
And it really, in terms of the process of making the film, I thought, wow, you know, there's going to be a lot more of this because, yeah, he did it right. And,
you know, once again, I one thing I liked about this too was Soderbergh gave a great commentary, and he had a friend who's a director, mm-hmm, basically be there with him. And Soderbergh has done that on a bunch of other movies where he has come and talked with directors of those movies. And it works out so well because some guy is in there to talk with them and ask them. But you were saying about the other ones, he's got 5 more of these movies to do. And I just wonder, is the thing I enjoyed about this, which is kind of a novelty, is that immediately going to wear off? And are these other movies going to get kind of grating, or is he going to find something new to do? Cause is he making them all the same way he's making this one? That's what he's sort of alluding to. They're not giving him any money. He's basically spending way less than $1 million on each of these movies.
And I think that's fine on the other hand, it's not, if part of this is an experiment to see how the distribution model works,
yep,
it's a self-contained one really, because it's not, the people who are going to see Bubble are going to see it.
Yeah.
It's not, if you do Ocean's 13 like this, that's an experiment.
Yeah.
If you simultaneously release Ocean's 13 or whatever with George, yeah, Clooney and Brad Pitt, then you actually get to see what people are doing. Releasing Bubble or small independent Soderbergh film number 2 like this doesn't really illuminate,
yeah,
what's going to happen in terms of people buying the DVD or going to the theater.
And you know, I felt for the first time in a very long time mildly guilty about buying it in the used bin at Blockbuster, because I'm thinking, oh, I'm ruining his. I mean, if this is going to be successful, I should have been buying it new for $29.99 rather than $7.99 in the used bin. I literally felt kind of guilty because I want Soderbergh to succeed.
And so do I. But I'm worried that this distribution experiment will fail just because his films don't have a broad enough appeal.
Yeah, there's that. That film has a very small appeal,
but a lot more than Schizopolis.
Yeah. Well, Schizopolis, he apparently didn't even want to, wasn't intending to release it. Well, you know, one of the things that I thought was interesting about this movie, that as I'm hearing them talk in the commentary, I realized that, wow, there's literally nothing that would stop you and me from making that movie other than basically talent. and I mean that seriously.
Well,
everything about that was he filmed it. He grabbed non-actors. They wrote scenarios. They shot it with nothing much better than the cameras that you and I have used, existing lighting with, except for one exception, he said. And basically, they filmed it in the actors' own homes.
But they did have, well, they used homes around that town.
Yeah. But it wouldn't be particularly
difficult. There was a small crew. It was bare bones. Yep. And they mentioned that. And they clearly had a crew that knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
And that had, you know, as he was talking about, God, was it the guy that, was it his DP or his editor? Mm-hmm. He said somebody that was on the K Street thing
with him.
And he said, if that guy can handle K Street, he can handle anything.
Yeah, they were talking about sound editing.
Oh, that's right, yeah. The sound guy.
Because in this one here, they just mic'd everybody and did their best.
Right. So I think you need some sort of crew that knows what the heck they're doing.
Yeah.
So I think that would hold us back. But in terms of, you're right, in terms of barriers to entry, the money isn't, you know, it's, you're right, it doesn't cost that much. And as more and more people, you know, as the cost of the cameras get cheaper and the editing software is already pretty friggin' cheap. And honestly, you can, I mean, I don't know how well iMovie can handle a 2-hour project.
Yeah.
But if all you're doing is jump cuts,
you can do
that in iMovie. So literally this practically free editing software is already out there.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's just about talent and quality. And getting over the fact that, you know, because both of us have video production experience, and the argument you run into when you're talking about it with other people,
though, is
because
graphic design has been around for
saying,
a long time.
I've seen my nephew do that.
On a professional level,
people recognize it's important.
Like, oh, actually,
you don't get,
yes, it does.
Yes. Well, it takes a little bit of knowledge. You know, the head guy of Coca-Cola saying, well, my 5-year-old can doodle a nice logo. Let's have them do it.
That's what they're saying.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So my 15-year-old, I don't know why I'm paying you. So you're right.
That's the worst thing about creative jobs.
Like our friend Adina, professional organizations that recognize its importance, right? And then podunk operations
every single
think
day
they can do it themselves
say, oh, I can do this and there's
or even internally
and
that people just not recognizing
thinking
that.
Because they
and
have
people that they would
Microsoft
be very
publisher
upset
in
if
their
somebody
arsenal
thought they could
they
just
know
do
what
their
they're
job
doing. But they feel perfectly comfortable telling a graphic designer, oh, I can do that. Yep. And video production, it's the same way. Somebody,
right.
Oh, my nephew did this, we can put it together. And they don't, and what's especially frustrating to the creative person is they actually don't recognize that their thing is demonstrably horribly, horribly worse. And it's not, and that's the challenge of a creative person explaining why your thing is better without putting somebody down.
And God, and what was that thing? Somebody, I found it on the internet and I forwarded it to you and Edwina, and it was the generic swoosh thing.
Oh, yeah.
And it was whenever you get like graphic designers in a room with a creative, with the client, and the client says, oh, I want something like the Nike swoosh.
Yeah.
You know, the graphic designers basically stab themselves under the table with a pen.
Yeah.
You know, and they basically regurgitate all this garbage until the lowest common denominator is satisfied. And
exactly.
Meanwhile, they hate themselves. And, oh, it was the greatest comment as I'm losing our friends and family audience tangentially.
What's next on that list of yours?
Also borrowed All the President's Men.
Oh, yeah. So you never seen that before?
Oh, I've seen it.
Oh, okay.
I've seen it before. It holds up pretty well.
Yeah, it's really well done.
I mean,
yeah, and we were watching Dick when you came in, the famous move, or the famous movie, the somewhat semi-famous sort of play on that. But it was kind of funny to see there's scenes in the Washington Post that pretty much exactly mirror All the President's Men, which pretty much mirror the real life movie, a real life location. It was kind of cool to see. But I love that movie. My God, it's such a...
Well, it's really...
You can see how people got really excited about being journalists in the 70s watching that movie.
Like I said, you know, it's really well done. It doesn't... The only parts that feel dated... Well, there's the stuff, you know, like using typewriters instead of computers as an actual thing, or Dustin Hoffman's hair, which is funny, though. You look at the pictures of Carl Bernstein, that's the hairy head.
I know. Carl Bernstein's hair is actually much worse looking. He's like an odd duck.
But aside from that, it's a great movie. And, yeah. And you're right. It just, it makes you depressed about the quality of journalism today.
Yeah.
And you're just like, who, you know, are they going to let, what a newspaper, and newspapers might, because despite all the criticism of, you know, the decline of the media, just about everyone else is still getting their primary reporting from newspaper reporting. Yeah. And so I'm sure there are still a few good news departments out there, but are they going to let a story develop? Are they going to have two reporters stay on something like this and keep them there?
Yeah.
Especially against the left-wing media criticism charges.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about it, you know, what's his name? Robert Redford did a commentary track, and he, which was really cool. It's like, wow, it's Robert Redford. And he's really, you know, he talks a lot and he does a good job. And he points out in this thing that one of the big differences between then and today was that the whole bunch of this movie was about them getting multiple sources. They would not run anything unless they got independent verification twice, you know, all this different stuff. And they just didn't run with stuff. And he points out today there's almost any of these major stories that broke are all single source stories, typically with somebody with an axe to grind. It's not necessarily not true, but that whole, the standards of journalism have changed. I'm not necessarily saying he's saying it's for the worse. I'm not necessarily saying it's for the worse or for the better. It's just fundamentally different. And I think that also the difference between now and then is stuff gets out, and now with the internet and with blogs and stuff, it's like a million flowers blooming, the Mao thing. People just attack it, you know, in a million different ways, versus the old days, you had to have a big newspaper that allowed somebody to stay on the story for an ever and ever. So I'm not so sure nowadays it's necessary for somebody to be able to stick to a story like that, because once the suspicion gets out there, you see all these other places jump on it. Downside is I don't think that it has ultimately the ultimate effect. They've been able to deflect a lot of things. There's been so many things in the past 4 to 6 years that have clearly could have risen to the level of Watergate and brought down the administration, and they've barely registered as a blip.
And yeah, but you and I, and there's a segment of the population that's very plugged in and follows all these stories through many different sources.
Yeah.
You know, we know to check certain blogs that have proven to have a good track record of being accurate. And you know, basically people that show up and do their own independent reporting, and you really have to view that with a critical eye. Does this person know what they're talking about, or are they wearing a tinfoil hat? And there's a percentage of the population that's very plugged in and knows what's going on, but there's another percentage of the population that if it's not on the nightly news, they're not hearing about it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, something like all these different scandals that pop up, you know, the NSA wiretapping blatantly being illegal.
Yep.
And it'll get mentioned, but it's not emphasized, and the media isn't saying, you know what, this is just objectively illegal.
Yeah.
Here's what they're saying. You know, here's what side A says about it. Here's what side B says about it. But it's just not getting the play.
But don't forget, it took 2 years for Watergate, over 2 years, for it to play out from they heard about it.
Right.
It was this thing. It simmered for it to finally have an effect. It's entirely possible the NSA thing or any number of other things would actually lead to Bush's impeachment. It's entirely possible. I'm not saying it's definitely happening, but I don't know. I mean, now we just sort of expect things
to
happen
right,
much
but
quicker.
Another difference between all the president's men being, you know, time period and what that's depicting and now would be you clearly had people in power who were seeing the story come out, calling and trying to intimidate and trying to suppress, saying, you can't say that, or you're in danger, or, you know, the lines are being wiretapped. Yep. And so I'm sure that's going on today, but today there's a whole other level to attacking the source, to saying, oh, you want the terrorists to win. Aren't you patriotic? Don't you love your country? You're left-wing media. And the level of pushback is so much more intense than it was for all the president's men.
Yeah.
You know, that time period. So I think that's another difference, but
yeah, I mean the election, where was it, in Rhode Island or wherever, where those people, the Republican operatives sat down and called the center.
New Hampshire phone jamming case.
I mean, that is simply the most appalling thing I think I've heard in the past 2 years It's so unbelievably undemocratic. It's so it goes so far beyond the pale, and I don't think they actually realize how awful that is. And I'm thinking about that, and now you're hearing that they've made phone calls to the White House or anything, and just like everything else, I keep thinking, this is the story. This is right. The one that's going to bring him down. We thought it was Katrina. We thought it was the war. We thought it was everything. And I keep thinking, well, maybe this is the one that brings him down. But somehow I suspect nothing is. So maybe you're right. There was a golden age, and we're beyond that. You can't bring an administration down.
Well, but you look, I wonder at what point did the, for all the president's men, for Watergate, at what point did the public really become aware? Because it's a string of small stories. It's, you know,
well, here, that's the thing, all the president's men. They specifically ended it at the point when the public was becoming aware.
Right. And you kind of, and so you look at, you try and find something analogous to today, and it's, is it going to be a high level official being indicted?
Yeah.
You know, you look at Scooter Libby being indicted, and that got a lot of attention, but it's still not quite enough.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you imagine Rove being indicted would be enough.
Yeah,
to get people's attention, but anyway, we've gone
beaten
far
that
afield.
Horse.
We've used all the president's men as our political.
I sure love that movie though. It's hard for me to evaluate it without thinking about all the politics, because I love the politics of the movie. But I just find it to be such a great movie.
If you
70s.
Go back for a second and you look at, you know, because some of the supplemental material they discuss. You know, talking to the Ben Bradley and talking to the reporters and trying to pitch it. You know, we want to make a movie about this. And Ben Bradley, the editor of the Washington Post, saying, you know, I'm really hesitant because if it plays wrong, we're going to look like idiots, which that's a extremely well-founded.
Ben Bradley is a smart
guy.
And it's funny because, man, talk about a movie that made them look great.
And yeah, it turned out great.
Yeah, without like lionizing them, just kind of describing them. It was, God, what a great movie.
And and so the leap of faith that everybody took, that Woodward took, that, you know, Bernstein and Ben Bradley and all these people that were involved, the leap of faith they took in saying this incredibly important story, the most important story of our generation, debatably, and saying, okay, we trust you enough to represent it.
Well, I don't know if you heard on the commentary track. I don't know if you heard the commentary track, but Redford was mentioning that he first caught wind of this story. This was before Nixon was going down or anything. He went and had a meeting with Bernstein and was pitching him to make a movie of this pretty much while it was happening. And it was going to be this weird little black and white film that they were going to film while it was happening. And Bernstein kept putting him off, saying it just isn't ready. And then so the movie came out in 76, but he wanted to film the movie before Nixon even had left office. He was trying to get a movie put together with no name actors. And finally, the financing said, listen, you know, if you want to put this movie, you need to get an actor. So they hired, you know, Dustin Hoffman, and they said, you know, you got to have a name to go along with him. Okay, I'll do it. Redford
did it.
That's
opposite of what they said in the supplemental.
Oh, maybe it was the other way.
They said, if you want the film to get made, you need to be in it.
Yeah, that's what I'm. You're right. It was that way, and then they needed to get somebody to be,
because otherwise it would be dominated by.
Exactly. So you're right. So, but originally the very first thought was they were going to make that movie pretty much while Watergate was happening, and I wonder what that movie would have been. I wonder what that would have been like. It would have been an interesting thought had it been the small black and white picture that was filmed while all the stuff was happening. It probably would have been a curio timepiece, because the fact that this thing came out in 76 gave him at least a little bit of time to look back and not just do it while the stuff was happening. Anyway, what was next on the list?
Mission Impossible 3.
Yes.
As we do a fantastic segue.
Despite everything, all, you know, Tom Cruise, I'm just totally looking forward to this. I'm hoping it
doesn't suck.
Especially
after Jeff Wells, who...
Oh, I haven't read it. What did he say?
He finally saw a screening and said, it's great.
Yeah.
He said, you know, it's not high art, but for the type of movie it is, a summer popcorn action film, it's about as good as it can possibly be.
Awesome.
And he said, it's really good. It's very tense. It doesn't let up. And he said, those who are expecting Philip Seymour Hoffman to really steal the show will be disappointed.
Oh, really?
Because he's just not given the material.
Oh, so that so the one scene they show you, it's not...
Well, he said Philip Seymour Hoffman was great,
yeah,
but he doesn't steal it from Tom Cruise.
And there's a lot of other big actors in this movie.
Well, Carrie Russell is one that kind of I'm interested to see because she was Felicity, basically. Yep. And I think of her as sort of being, I've seen a few episodes.
Yep.
I think of her as sort of being the hot chick with the long, you know, just a co-ed.
Yep.
So as an action star will be an interesting.
Well, isn't that, what's his name? Reese Myers, Jonathan Reese, Davies, Meyer, whatever the hell his name
is.
I think he's in it. The guy that was in Match Point and that looks like, that played Elvis. You know,
Jonathan, the one I'm thinking of is Davies.
No, not him. No, the guy who was in Match Point, who starred in that, he played, he was the guy in Bend It Like Beckham, the male love interest to Keira Knightley. I don't know. He's the hot young actor. He's the guy who played.
Like I was staring at anything other than Keira Knightley in that movie.
He was in that Elvis biopic last year. And oh my God, the guy, because of his forehead and his eyes, guy looks so much like Elvis. It was not a great movie, but it was literally like they had found Elvis to star in a movie. It was incredible. So anyway, I'm definitely looking forward to the movie.
As am I. The only problem is it opens. I'm vacationing in Hawaii.
No, go see it in Hawaii.
Week.
Let your future wife.
Except we're doing it with a bunch of friends.
Kauai.
And we're in Kauai.
Kauai.
And I'm sure there's a theater there, but apparently a lot of that island is very rural.
Yeah.
And the odds of trundling everybody into our rental and driving 40 minutes to get to the theater while we're in Hawaii is pretty low. So I'm gonna have to see it a little later than everybody else.
Was this a pre-honeymoon? Are you going to go on a honeymoon?
No, the trip was booked before we got engaged.
Oh, okay.
So it's a bunch of friends. It's going to be fun. Never been to Hawaii before.
Cool.
And one of the reasons I was really stoked, I thought Kauai was where they filmed Lost.
No,
apparently it's Oahu.
But where did they film the famous scene in Jurassic Park where
that might have been Kauai.
Where they have that beautiful valley and also the Pearl Harbor, where the planes fly through that valley,
too. Pearl Harbor. I don't remember if the Raiders stuff was Kauai or Oahu. And then 6 Days, 7 Nights.
Another wonderful movie.
I saw, but I have no interest in seeing where where it was filmed.
Ivan Reitman's got some new movie coming out that it's got kind of like a Ghostbusters bent to it. So maybe it'll be good. He hasn't done a good movie in a very long time, but... You know, it's funny. I got interested in him again because Thank You for Smoking. His son did such a great movie. I'm thinking, well, maybe Ivan Reitman. I mean, I don't, for whatever reason, it got me interested in Ivan Reitman again. So it's new movie. I can't remember who's starring in it, but it's a big budget movie that deals with a little of the paranormal and stuff. I'm thinking, good, familiar territory for him. Maybe he can deliver. But then again, he did that. What was that movie, Evolution? Did you ever see that?
Oh, yeah.
Holy God, what an awful movie. Talk about a movie that works on no levels whatsoever. It tries on a million, but not at all.
I'm trying to remember how I saw it because you don't have it, do you?
No, God, no. That was David Duchovny.
It must have been on TV.
And Juliana Moore, and you're thinking, oh, great, she's branching out. She should be great, and she tries, but oh, it's terrible. And who was the other person in it?
Eddie Griffin.
Yeah, or something. Yeah, terrible movie.
Yeah, it really was, and it was Dan Aykroyd has a cameo in the end. But you're exactly right, because I'd have to see it again to see what it could have been, but I'm not going to.
Yeah.
But yeah, you kind of hope, boy, and because I was a huge X-Files fan,
yeah.
And so I was really rooting for David Duchovny to achieve success, and he really hasn't.
Yeah.
He's done some stuff, like the one where he was a doctor that becomes a doctor to the mob, and then the Return to Me, the heart transplant one.
I actually liked Return to Me. I thought I thought it was a really.
I have a Return to Me promotional yo-yo.
I have a Return to Me.
I don't know where the hell it came
DVD
from.
Was a Return to Me free DVD because it won some award from animal rights groups because it was very positive about animal.
Oh, that's
stuff.
Probably where I got the yo-yo from.
Yeah.
Probably from Mark.
And it was, but it was a night, it was directed by Bonnie Hunt of all people. And it was a very nice, romantic kind of comedy and drama. It was a good movie, but the movie, he directed that movie with Robin Williams. In
oh,
it last
that's
year.
Right. The 70s
house,
period piece.
Wasn't it called the House of, was that the one that was House of Yes or the or something? Anyway, oh, terrible reviews. Robin Williams, it seems like about nowadays, about half of the movies he gets in don't even get released.
Well, this new one, RV. Who cares?
I know. It was interesting with it because, you know, this movie
If that's du jour family film, fine.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that the movie they only spent $50 million on this movie, including William's salary and everything. And it was directed by Barry Sonnenfeld. And they had this big article in the New York Times about Sonnenfeld and how he directed Men in Black 2. And it was the worst mistake of his life and how it just destroyed everything thereafter. He couldn't get any other movie made, and the one movie he kept working on that got pulled from him was the Lemony Snicket movie, and it was all from this experience of how bad Men in Black 2 was and perceived to be. So here it was like he's returning to a movie where it was like, yes, you can make this movie, but you're only going to get $50 million. And sort of the same thing for Robin Williams. He's not that much of a name anymore, so they're trying to do a high concept, funny comedy of people in an RV, but we're not going to, unlike other movies where you'd assume it's going to be like an Adam Sandler movie, which would be the same thing. For no reason, they'd spend $140 million on this. This, they chose to spend $50
million. Well, and $50 million even sounds like a lot.
It does, but in the context of movies like that.
Because then you look at Bubble, and you're like,
$500,000.
Need to spend a lot of money to make a movie if you do it.
Yeah.
I mean, granted,
I totally agree, but just the simple fact is a movie like that in Hollywood these days, for whatever reason, an Adam Sandler movie or something like that, they spend $120 million on a movie that has absolutely no business having that much they spent on it.
It's absolutely insane.
What's next on the list, dude?
Do you know when Southland Tales comes out?
No, I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
This is the guy who did Donnie Darko.
Yep.
It's his next film. And
it's got all kinds of people. It's got The Rock in it. It's got all kinds of people in it.
Kevin Smith. It's got Sean William Scott.
Yep.
Stifler from American Pie. Apparently in a meaty non-Stifler role.
He was even going to have Artie Lang from the Howard Stern show on, but Howard kind of nixed it because he would have had to fly to L.A. and do some other stuff.
So I'm really excited to see this movie, and I haven't heard anything about it in a while now, so
Have they filmed it?
Let's go.
They filmed it, right?
I think so.
Yeah. Who knows what's going on? I heard a couple little things about it, but nothing big. So.
Yeah.
I don't know. What does Paul Thomas Anderson have any movie coming out besides the Prairie Home Companion that he basically co-directed? I didn't realize he's been going out with Maya Rudolph for 2 years. She's in this movie, and then they mention in passing
Maya Rudolph?
The gal from Saturday Night Live who does the
okay,
the one whose mom was Minnie Riperton, and
that doesn't mean anything to me.
She's
but
the one
I,
that
I know
sang
who
the
Maya
song.
Rudolph is now.
Loving you is easy. You know that song
for when John Stamos's brother hits the high note,
exactly.
And the cow blows up.
That's that was her. She died like
South
a
Park
cancer when she was like 30 or something, and so Maya Rudolph never really knew her mom, but that's who and she's also in the Prairie Home Companion, so that's probably the connection there. But anyway, I just been wondering, man, I love that guy's movies, and it's been a long time since Punch Drunk Love. So he didn't do one after that. Am I missing one?
I don't think so.
That was like 5 years ago at this point.
I thought I had something else. I don't have anything else on my list really, but I thought of something else. And
been watching much TV lately?
Really nothing new. I'm excited now that the end of the seasons are coming up. Yeah. So once CSI is done, I can go back and catch all the My Name is Earl reruns. I'm excited for that. I'm excited for all the Simpsons reruns I've missed this year.
I haven't seen many.
West Wing has three left.
Three left.
Makes me sad. But we talked about that a little bit last time. So
I did, you know, last Sunday, it was Sunday morning. It was Easter. And I actually turned on the TV. I don't watch much TV, but I turned it on and I was watching. And I love how, you know how the cable channels, whenever there's a holiday, they put on little marathons. So it might
Like,
so who knows what it is. It might be a While You Were Out marathon, or it might be a CSI marathon. So I was watching the National Geographic channel, which is a great channel. And of course, in honor of the Easter holiday, it was a marathon of documentaries about prisons. In honor of Easter, of course. it was so apropos of nothing. And I was just thought it was funny. There it was like 7 a.m. on Easter, and I'm watching a movie about maximum security San Quentin.
God, man, a bunch of people ask me, what are you doing for Easter? And I would look around. I'm a heathen, so I'm going to be sitting on my couch and, I don't know, watching TV.
You know what's weird about that?
Have some cereal.
I think the further East Coast people get, I think Seattle has no tradition of Easter. Because there's this gal who...
well, this is one of the most secular cities in the country.
We have this. I have this gal who works for me at the place I run, and she was like... going, oh God, it's Easter. So all the stores are going to be closed, you know, cause we have volunteers that go out into these stores to adopt out animals, cats. And I'm going, no. But nobody's going to be out shopping cause you know, it's Easter. And I go, no, it's probably going to be packed because you know, people don't care. I had to like stop and go, is Easter like a big deal somewhere you're from? Cause I'm going to tell you, it is nothing here. It's certainly not religious. And even the non-religious part isn't a particularly big deal. But she was dumbfounded, and a lot of people
from the
East
Coast. Although I did try and get a pizza that Sunday.
Oh, and it was closed?
The Papa...
It's the Catholic connection, Papa Murphy's there.
Yeah, that was it.
Oh, no, I'm thinking of Father Murphy.
God, you know what else? Daily Show came back from a week hiatus.
Yeah.
And, God, that show is just so friggin' brilliant.
And so
you're looking at stuff like, you know, Scott McClellan announces he's resigning.
Yep.
And all I can think of is I can't wait to get the Daily Show take on this, and they don't disappoint.
Yeah, it gets to the point where you just assume they're going to do something, and it must put high pressure on them because they know now they have to cover things. Even if they wanted to try something different, there's an expectation and they have to deliver. And 98% of the time they deliver way and above, but it must be a little difficult on that show to start realizing we can't not do stuff. We literally have this high standards of expectations.
Well, if you're talking about them avoiding stories, I mean, if it's the fake news, if it's in the news, they're going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
So it's not like they're not going to do Rove or whoever's the press secretary resigning.
Yeah.
So you know that's going to happen anyway. That's part of their raison
d'etre. What was their take on? I didn't see the McClellan stuff.
Oh, they masterfully edited some stuff together, and I don't even remember now, but it was very funny.
And oh yeah. They were talking about when Clinton will stand behind them and they're going to like laugh in their old age and sit in rocking chairs about their.
Oh yeah. The good old days. What day was that? When was it the good old day?
Oh my God.
But it just The Daily Show is friggin' brilliant. Yeah. I don't know what we would do if we didn't have The Daily Show.
Jesus, thank God for The Daily Show.
All right, I think we're scraping the bottom of our barrel here. Do you have anything else you want to talk about?
Nope, nothing much.
Nothing much. So apparently there is something, but you just don't want to dredge it up.
I don't know. I can't think of a damn thing. Oh, I did get some new DVDs.
Really?
I did get The Bad News Bears, the original one.
Stack. Let me go.
I finally picked it up. There's no, it's too bad. Michael Ritchie, I think, who directed the original one. I think he died, so there's no commentary track or anything. But it literally is, I believe, one of my top 10 favorite movies of all time. And then I got All Quiet on the Western Front, the original one.
It's
like a sound movie, but one of the very first ones.
Oh, really?
So I just thought, and unfortunately, there's no commentary or anything, but I thought, what the heck, I'll see it. One of the original anti-war films filmed shortly after the World War II, World War I, about like 10 years later. So I thought that might be kind of interesting. And then what was the last one I got? Oh, yeah. Trials of Henry Kissinger. That was, I think, co-directed by the guy who did that Why We
Fight.
Yeah,
Eugene Jarecki.
Which I didn't like Why We Fight, but I really liked this one. This one is just basically making the case that Henry Kissinger is a war criminal. And it makes a pretty effective case. And you start to realize why Henry Kissinger avoids flying to certain countries and other stuff. Because the guy simply was... for what he did in Vietnam and what he was going, by any outside observer, you would say, no, he is a war criminal. He should be prosecuted by international courts.
I've been reading Best and the Brightest for probably a year now.
Yep.
It's just such a dense book, and it's not a quick read, so I'll do a couple pages a night, and it's taken me forever, because I've read probably 10 other books in the interim, and so far he hasn't discussed Kissinger.
Kissinger was an amazing guy, and he not only did he do all this Machiavellian crap, but the most amazing thing that we forget is I think it was like 1974, he engineered, got himself basically picked as the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's insane.
Which is incredible. You think of all the people, yet he somehow managed to get himself in. Is the disc all scratched up?
It looks pristine.
So one of the people they have in there, the
talking heads.
Nobody
watched it.
is Christopher Hitchens, who is always lucid and always great when he's talking about Henry Kissinger. And he's the one that's been beating the drum. So it's really, really entertaining. Christopher Hitchens, I find him to be the most dense writer on the planet. But when you hear him talk, and it's killed me that the past couple of years he's been this big pro-war guy. And although I clearly is kind of regretting it and changing his stance. But he's so great when he talks about two people, Henry Kissinger and Mother Teresa. There's nothing more entertaining than hearing him because he's got the goods on these people.
It's, you know, and this is one of those interesting things for me. I hear the name Henry Kissinger. Almost immediately, the Monty Python song starts playing in my head.
Which Monty Python song?
Henry Kissinger, I'll be missing you. And I don't know the rest. But just that little tune starts. And, you know, there are some things that happen like that where, you know, you've formed this association based on, you know, someone else satirizing it. And so, and that happens a lot. And Monty Python, I think, is responsible for quite a bit. So you hear Mary, Queen of Scots, I think of the sketch where she's being beaten. Or
I'll tell you, dude.
The Spanish Inquisition, Mel Brooks, History of the World Part 1. Yep. And you start singing this little ditty of a song.
Oye, Gava. Inquisition.
What a show. All right, we got to stop before we have to pay royalties.
Okay. Hey, speaking of, I saw the movie And Now for Something Completely Different the other day. It was on late night.
I don't know if I've ever seen that.
It's basically, I'm not sure what the thing was. I think what they did is they refilmed a bunch of their classic bits at the time the show was going on so they could release a movie internationally. Because don't forget, you know, Monty Python wasn't on in America until like 5 years after it was on in Britain. So I think they sent it out there. And I remember seeing it for the first time around 1980. It was on TV, on Canadian TV. And I remember laughing so hard. It was the funniest thing I ever saw. The upper class twit competition and the ex-parrot thing and other stuff. So unbelievably funny. And the goer, you know what I mean? That thing. Well, what was interesting was I didn't find any of it funny at all. I could appreciate what I found funny before, but it was not funny at all. And I'm starting to realize that, wow, you know, my dad, I'm asking my dad about what he thinks funny. He's talking about watching, who was the old Red Skelton and his Clem Cadiddlehopper sketch. And him and my uncle will start talking about how funny it is. And they'll be laughing and I'll be laughing with them. And I'll be going, oh my God, it's so not funny at all in anything that I would consider funny. And I wonder at what point because there's obviously people, they get something funny at a certain level and then they don't progress much beyond that. So when they're 70, they're still thinking about something when they were 40 or 30 was funny. And I'm wondering what that'll be for me and what I'm going to be thinking when I'm 70 about this stupid stuff nowadays that isn't funny. Or I don't know, maybe I'll keep changing. But man, that Monty Python, I love Monty Python. And I think Monty Python, The Life of Brian, it's one of my favorite movies of all time. But a lot of this stuff, I don't really find all that funny at all. So that's me. Sorry if you love Monty Python.
Wow. I wasn't quite sure where you were going with that.
I didn't mean to rant, but what are your thoughts on Monty Python? I mean, do you still find him funny?
Yeah, actually, I've got the DVD box set of everything and very, very slowly working through it. And I've seen a lot of it before. I think some of it is just sublimely funny.
Yeah.
It's just so ridiculous and they nailed the presentation so well because it's a lot of it was their presentation. If you take the same material and had another comedy troupe do it, it wouldn't necessarily work, but their presentation just was great. And not all of it's a home run. I'll see some, you know, some sketch and I can see what they were going for. I just don't find it funny. But yeah, a lot of it, I really love and it still holds up. And God, I think about there's this gigantic coffee table book, The Pythons, by The Pythons, the autobiography that I got for Christmas, and I've been flipping through that. And so, you know, hearing that the original title was maybe going to be an alternate title for the Monty Python's Flying Circus was going to be Owl Stretching Time. I think that's hysterical. That just, it so sums up. That to me is funny. I think that would still work today. I've thought about maybe stealing the name for something.
Owl Stretching.
A little too derivative, but
that's cute.
I don't know. So I find a lot of Monty Python still very funny.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It didn't do it for me, but I can appreciate them. But for some reason, I'm just not laughing my way through it like the way I laughed through Thank You for Not Smoking last week or whatever. But I don't know. But I could watch Life of Brian a million times and just laugh. I remember the first, I remember watching it, just laughing so dang hard. And I remember having my girlfriend at the time, I said, hey, her friend and her friend's new boyfriend, and inviting him, hey, let's watch this movie. It's so dang funny. And unbeknownst to me, that her friend and her friend's boyfriend were just starting to go out
coming.
And they decided, you know how when you first start going out with somebody and you think, oh, they go to church, so I'm going to be more religious than them because I think that's important to them. And then the other person thinks, oh, that person, religion's important, so I'm going to out-religion them. And it takes you like a couple weeks to realize, oh, we don't give a crap about any of this stuff. Well, I caught them at that time where they hadn't figured that out yet. So we put in Monty Python, put in Life of Brian, which is the funniest movie I think I've ever seen, or one of the funniest. And we're watching, and they're looking at each other. And every time something funny comes up where they're, you know, spoofing on Christianity or something, I'd see them cut glances at each other. And about 15 minutes in, my wife's friend says, oh, I get it. They're just making fun of Christianity. And I go, yeah, but it's not really
they make fun of religion.
Well, you know what I'm saying.
That's an important distinction, though.
Of course, dude. I'm just saying what they're saying, and I'm going, well, yeah, you know, but it's like so it's just a big, like hour and a half of them putting down Christianity and Christ, and I'm going, yeah. Anyway, you know, maybe we'll turn this off and watch Out of Africa. We all surround. No. I'm enjoying it. Let's watch this. Yeah, okay. And then stoic through the whole movie. And I'm like trying to laugh. And every time I laugh and they look at me like, yeah, look at that heathen. A couple of jerks. Literally, if they'd watched it 2 weeks later, it would have been absolutely fine. But talk about ruining a movie.
Yeah, I remember watching it. We had kind of a party at a friend's house. And my girlfriend at the time was more religious than I. And she, 5 minutes in, decided it was an anti-Christian, anti-religious movie. She just got up and left.
Ugh.
She just like went to some other part of the house we were in. And
wait, anybody I think who is a true Christian would find that movie terrific.
Well, and it's the brilliance of the movie is, I mean, they play Jesus in the movie straight.
Yeah.
I mean, they show the Sermon on the Mount, and he's preaching and he's playing it straight. And it's, you know, saying, be good to other people. You know, the meek shall inherit the earth. And it's only, you know, they got the pythons. The Greek, the cheesemaker shall inherit the earth. Well, it's a parable. Everyone in the dairy industry is covered. And
well, you know, the other thing about the movie that after I started studying all these left wing radical groups of the 70s, and you realize that so much of the movie, it's clearly from that milieu, and they have a documentary on there in the movie where they mention that too. And so when they're talking about them saying, you know, that somebody's from the People's Front of Judea,
yeah,
what splitters the people's, you know, effing front for Judea.
Wait a minute. We're that group.
And it was, and honestly, the discussions they were having and all that stuff about that is exactly what was going on with all the leftist radical groups at the time. Uh-huh. They just sat around discussing themselves and focusing on how much they hate these others that are almost identical to them. I mean, it was a really a brilliant, brilliant movie.
Really is.
So anyway, it is now 1:03, so we probably should wrap it up.
Okay. Well, we should remind people that A, you've been listening to Mustard Ayonnaise.
Mm-hmm.
B, you can send comments, which I forgot to check the email address before I came over. There could be stuff waiting
to reset
because a few
email.
People actually heard the last
That's
one.
That's true. The three people listened for the first 3 minutes where they clicked off.
No, a couple people actually listened to the whole
thing. Yeah, I was stunned when you sent me that. I'm going, wow, they're commenting on something that's like at minute 43. That's incredible. That's so inspiring.
Oh, that reminds me. I didn't make my correction.
What was the correction?
I made this comment about in Mission Impossible 2 when Tom Cruise does this retarded motorcycle stunt where he hops off the side of the bike and is dragging himself along. I said nobody ever does that, not even the best rider. Well, my buddy, who's in sort of a motorcycle club down in the Bay Area, pointed out that actually people do that all the time, and I'm just an idiot.
But
so.
See, here's my thought on corrections. We are both idiots. We are regularly going to say stupid things.
I had such
things.
An air of authority when I said that I feel like I should correct myself and say, no, I was wrong. Thank you, Preston, for correcting me. I think what I should have said was anybody that does that is retarded. And I can think of maybe the only less safe thing you could do is a headstand on a moving motorcycle while naked.
Isn't that what killed that guy, the Indian Larry? Wasn't he doing a headstand?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But it was clearly stupid. You go to various shows and you'll see these insane motorcycle video stunts of these idiots just doing this stuff on motorcycles, which, well, is insane. So I guess I shouldn't underestimate what people will do. So I apologize for my mischaracterization of the Mission Impossible 2
motorcycle stunt. On behalf of the audience, I accept your apology.
That's very gracious of you.
So what is our web address?
Customer comments, if you will. You guys rock at mustardayonnaise.com.
And it's spelled just like it sounds.
It really is. Mustard and then the last half of mayonnaise.
Exactly.
I think out of our listeners right now, I think maybe one of them would actually get that.
I know. At some point in the distant
future, we'll explain it. In the future, if you don't know what it is. But it makes sense. Just trust us.
Exactly.
All right. So thanks for listening. I'm Matt.
I'm Richard.
And we may or may not be back next week. We have to discuss that.
Adios, muchachos.
All right. We'll be right back.